Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. His name is John Connolly. I'm sure you've heard the name, writer of many crime novels, and he's got a new anthology. I guess you would call it an anthology of books to die for. It's the world's greatest mystery writers on the world's greatest mystery novels. Hello.
Hi, how are you, David?
I'm just good to talk to you. This is such a pretty book, actually. I'm holding the American version here.
Well, thank you. It's very nice of you to say.
It really catches your eye.
It's a nice edition. But you know, we wanted it to be that kind of book because I guess it's the kind of book that if you like mysteries, you might like to keep on your shelf as a book to take off occasionally and dip into when you've run out of stuff to read. Because it is a kind of guide for people who maybe read a lot of new stuff in the genre, or maybe think that they've read an awful lot of stuff in the genre, and maybe want to explore a little bit more deeply, I suppose.
Now, do you know all of these people that wrote in here?
Oh, do I know all the people? Have I read all the books, or do I know all the people?
Do you know all the people?
One of the nice things about, I suppose, being a writer and having been a writer for about the last decade or so is that I've bumped into a lot of people along the way. And, you know, inevitably some writers have become friends and some are acquaintances and some you just know to kind of nod your head to in the bar.
Right.
But it meant that when Declan and I came, because I have a co-editor on this, Declan Burke, when we came to do it, there were a lot of people that we knew personally. You know, I know Mike Connolly, I know Lee Child. So it's not like a stranger asking them out of the blue to do something.
Right.
Your relationship with them is slightly different. So maybe that's why I think if you look at the lineup of writers in it, it's pretty A-list. Because we knew a lot of these people, and I think our relationship with them was slightly different because of that.
Yeah, and what's interesting is to get everybody's take on what their favorite one was. And how do you pick a favorite one? I mean, we all have multiple books.
It depends upon the day that you're asked. But I suppose the question we asked people was, if you were in a bar, if they were in a bar with you, if you happened to bump into one of these writers in a bar one evening and the talk turned to books, because it would inevitably talk to books, and you said, and they'd say to you, have you read X? And you'd go, no. And they would love that book so much that they would go out and buy a copy for you. They'd tell you, stay there, mind my drink, and I'll be back in 5 minutes. And they'd find a bookstore, and God, in the good old days when there were that many bookstores, and would bring a copy of the book back for you. And curiously, we all have a couple of those books, but they're often spread across a couple of genres. And actually, most people, when we asked them, when we approached them, really did have one book that they returned to again and again, which was quite interesting. And I suppose the relationship of mystery writers to mysteries is slightly different, perhaps, from the relationship of a general reader to novels. You know, we've all picked up a book by a writer that's just changed the way we think about books. You know, if someone asked me to pick one, almost immediately I'd go for The Chill by Ross Macdonald.
Right.
Because The Chill was just one of those books that changed the way I thought about writing mysteries. And I suppose that's what we're talking about here, in that a lot of the books people chose were kind of books that spurred them on to become writers in a way, or altered the way that they thought about what they might do. And they were often books that they started reading before they became mystery writers themselves. So, you know, Michael Connolly was an interesting one. Everybody assumed he would write about The Long Goodbye because, you know, he's spoken a lot about Chandler, and Chandler's a huge influence on him, and The Long Goodbye is a huge influence. But it turns out that what actually spurred him on was seeing the movie of The Long Goodbye, not the book. He saw Robert Altman's film, which I think is from 1974, although I could be pulled up on that, but I suspect it's about that.
Right.
And he saw the film as a student, and he thought, God, this film's brilliant. You know, who wrote this book? And so he then goes out and begins reading Chandler. But the Chandler novel that enraptures him or captures his attention is The Little Sister. Now, The Little Sister wouldn't be most people's favorite Chandler novel. It's regarded possibly as a more minor book than Farewell, My Lovely, or The Long Goodbye, or The Big Sleep. But it's the one that he felt most passionate about, and I suppose that goes to the heart of the book. We wanted writers to talk about a book they loved. Not a book, you know, that they necessarily admired from a distance, or they felt should be kind of wrapped in plastic and put on a shelf, but a book that they genuinely, genuinely loved. And sometimes those books are not necessarily the best known of a writer's work.
Right.
And I think that's what made it interesting. So while the book does cover, you know, Mark Billingham writes about The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett, and I think it's David Peace perhaps writes about The Glass Key by Hammett. You know, they're two key Hammett novels. You couldn't really dispute them. Similarly, Linwood Barclay writes about, I think he writes about The Galton Case by Ross MacDonald, and I write about the show by Ross MacDonald. You know, some writers got two books. So we don't really, the book doesn't miss out on very many writers. I mean, it cannot be definitive because everybody has a different opinion. But sometimes the entry book that's chosen is quite interesting, you know, and is often not the usual suspect.
Well, that's what's interesting about the book. You're getting to see everybody's perspective and say, well, why would they pick this one? I've got to find out why they picked this novel of all the novels out there.
When a writer writes about a book that he or she loves, they're writing about themselves. I mean, that's what I found interesting when I began reading the essays. That's not to say that somebody from Michael Connelly begins writing about Raymond Chandler, all you hear about is Michael Connelly. But you get to see how the writer who became Michael Connelly was formed. Yeah. And I think that's really interesting. You know, one of the stories, I'm a huge Joseph Wambaugh fan. I think Wambaugh is one of the most underrated writers in the genre. Somebody who transformed writing about policemen.
And he's still writing today.
And he's still writing today. The man is in his 80s. I mean, he's a considerable figure, Wambaugh. But he writes, he contributed one of the loveliest essays. And he's somebody that I didn't know. I had never met him. And we had never had any contact. But I through somebody who shared an agent with him, I got a contact for him. And he got it immediately, and he said, also, he never gets asked to write for these things, which I found extraordinary. But he delivered a lovely essay where, as a young policeman, he'd written two novels, I think, by that point. And he used to see a guy wandering around the police department who was clearly a pariah in the department. You know, nobody would talk to him, and he was like a ghost moving through the LAPD. And it turned out that he had... there had been an altercation between himself and his partner and two criminals. And in the course of this, he had handed over his gun to one of the criminals because he thought they were going to be killed. And the criminal said, listen, give me your gun or we're going to start shooting. And the criminal used his gun to kill his partner. And it took place in an onion field outside Los Angeles. And, you know, Wambaugh thought, this is a fantastic story here because it speaks about a whole lot of things, about friendship and loyalty, but also institutions and the police. But he said, you know, that's going to be a non-fiction novel. You know, that's effectively what it's going to be. That's what I want to write. But that's a very ambitious thing to try to do. And so he's on a chat show, and suddenly this strange little man comes into the room. He's going to be on a chat show with him, and it's Truman Capote. You know, Capote is the man who created, in effect, the non-fiction novel Within Cold Blood.
Wow, yeah.
So for a young writer to be wrestling with this idea about a book and suddenly to find yourself sitting beside Truman Capote is an act of serendipity. And he did what any kind of writer with half a brass neck would do, which is to say, listen, Truman, mate, I've got an idea for a book. And it turns out Capote, you know, thinks that's a fantastic idea, invites him down to Florida. And so he gets to share this idea with a man who created this form. And
wow.
That book probably would not have been written had it not been for that little serendipitous moment of contact. And that's what's lovely in the book. A lot of the essays are about writers meeting writers. Whether they meet them in person or encounter them in the form of a book, there's a very personal relationship between writers. Like I said, it's not better or worse than the relationship between a reader and a writer. But I think a writer probably approaches a book, or a writer in the process of formation, approaches a book on two levels, not just as a reader, but as somebody who possibly aspires to doing this as well. And if you find a book that encapsulates something for you, that sets off a little fire or a little kind of ache inside you that wasn't there before, that's a transformative moment for you as a writer, and the book is filled with those kind of transformative moments.
Right. And I guess a lot of times, and I've read books myself, and I read them and I think, God, I wish I could write like this.
Yeah, there's always that element to it. And, you know, I think what happens with these books that writers love is that, you know, when you read Connelly writing about Chandler, for example, he kind of admits that he's never going to be able to write like that. And that's part of the appeal of that book. And I think as a reader, or for anybody who aspires to write, you know, I don't come out of a writing college, and I've never read a how-to book, you know, those kind of how to write a novel, these things with weird things about three acts and stuff. Most writers learn about writing from reading other writers. And you learn about writing by reading writers who are better than you are. You know,
right.
You don't learn anything from reading a bad book. You don't learn anything from reading bad writers. Whether as a reader or as a writer, you know, they're effectively a waste of your time.
But there are also books that are really badly written that can still be interesting to read.
And you don't always want to get onto an aircraft with Dostoevsky. At the same time, you know, that's going to be very tedious. And yeah, and according to our mood, we will want to, you know, I'm quite happy to read escapist pieces of fiction. Although as I get older, I realize that I have only so much time left to read. You know, and maybe my duty to myself as a reader is not to waste my time. And so I have very little patience now for bad books, and I have very little patience for average books.
Well, how when you read a book, how soon into the book do you know that it's bad?
That's the great, because I'm one of those people who, until recently, really struggled with putting down a book I wasn't enjoying. Because, in a sense, as readers, we blame ourselves when we're not enjoying a book. I think it's our tendency. We assume that there's something wrong with us rather than the book. And that can sometimes be the case. I mean, I remember in my early 20s trying to read Bleak House by Charles Dickens. Because it was on a college course that I was doing.
Right.
And, you know, I only had a week to read about three plays and one novel and one American novel and a bunch of poetry. You can't read Bleak House in a week. Unless you're doing nothing else and you can immerse yourself in it totally. But also I found it a difficult book. And I thought, well, maybe I'm never going to read this book. Maybe this book isn't for me.
Right.
But I came back to it. I probably about 8 or 9 years. I was in South Africa, actually, my first big book tour. And I brought it with me on the plane because I figured I have 11 hours on a plane. And if I'm not going to get into it, if I don't get into Bleak House now, I'm never going to get into it. And suddenly that becomes the right time to read a book. Or, you know, you can pick up a book where, I mean, I often think that sometimes you can pick up a book that has no meaning for you at that particular time in your life, because the things the book is talking about are not things that you've encountered. You know, I'd pick something. Let's say maybe the death of a parent. You know, if you possibly haven't gone through the death of a parent, then a book that deals with parental mortality, its impact upon you is not maybe going to be quite as visceral. It will be something that's in the future rather than something that has happened. If you've lost a parent and you read a book that deals with that, your relationship with the book is very, very different. Similarly, you know, books about if you've had your heart broken in a really, really desperate way, you know, in a very adult way, not in an ephemeral way, then a book about that kind of adult experience is going to have a different impact upon you than it would when if you read it when you were 16, possibly. You know, So I'm saying that sometimes it's the right book at the wrong time. You know, that's what it is. But I think also as readers, the more we read, we understand about if you're 50 or 60 pages into a book, you can be 5 pages into a book, and you'll just know you're reading dead prose.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I was, God love him, you know, he's the whipping boy for everybody. But 2 pages, at the moment when I began reading Da Vinci Code, and he described whatever the guy's name is looking like Harrison Ford in Tweed, and I thought, this is not a good book. You know, if you can't even be bothered to give the guy a description other than picking up a random actor and going, he looks a bit like him in a jacket, you know, that's kind of poor writing. And now, that's not to say that...
Is it lazy writing, maybe?
Well, absolutely. But lazy writing and poor writing are very similar. There's not really a whole lot of difference. You can maybe have more respect for poor writing because at least poor writing may be aspiring to something greater. Lazy writing just can't be bothered. You know, and should you give your time as a reader to a writer who can't be bothered? And that's not to say that there aren't moments of entertainment in The Da Vinci Code, and a whole lot of people read it and a whole lot of people enjoyed it.
Right.
It's a good airplane read, but it's a bit like finishing a Happy Meal.
I hated the ending of it. I hated
nearly all of it. So by the time the ending came around, I really had very little hate left in me. I didn't even hate it. I just thought this is an inconsequential.
You know what's interesting about you, John, though, is you're such an interesting writer, but you're as much an interesting person as you are a writer.
No, you're just there. Did you get that check I sent you?
But you are. When I first met you in Bryn Mawr, I was totally enthralled when you spoke for an hour and a half, whatever it was. And, you know, I just couldn't believe how interesting you were.
I mean, Irish people are just bred with too many opinions. You know, we're sent out into the world going, there you go. If you talk long enough, someone will buy you a drink.
But you think of all the writers out there, and a lot of them, you know, would rather not be talked to. They'd rather just write.
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, you for a long time, you could get away with being a writer and simply stay up in your garage, and you can still do that. You know, you can still sit in a room and just write and send your books out into the world occasionally, and you don't actually have to interact with readers if you don't want to. There is more of an expectation, I think, now that writers will interact with readers on a personal level.
Thank God, or I wouldn't be able to do these shows.
Well, absolutely, but, you know, but it's also, you know, I quite like going out and discussing books with readers and booksellers.
But that's
what I do for a living. You know,
and you're easy going with it, so you don't...
Well, I don't, people are interesting. I come from a journalistic... My background is journalism, and people are... Everybody is interesting. I mean, there's some people you don't want to be trapped in an elevator with. They're, you know, that might be too interesting. But everybody has a story. But if you're going into bookstores and talking to the kind of people who come along to book signings or readings, apart from you, every so often you get just a nutcase who comes along for the free wine, and you know, you learn to deal with them.
Exactly.
But by and large, you're dealing with people who are passionate about books, and people who care enough about what you do or are curious enough about it to leave their home maybe on a cold, wet night and come out to a bookstore. And you know, that's deeply touching and flattering for a writer. And the very least that you can do then is meet them halfway.
And I remember, and I'm still to this day scared to death of Lawrence Block.
Oh, he's an imposing figure. And I remember briefly meeting Andrew Vax, you know, who was clearly not going to engage on that level. You know, he was a very interesting man, but was perhaps not, didn't want to have a very warm relationship with strangers. And that's perfectly understandable.
Right.
But on the other hand, the flip side of that is that increasingly readers almost expect writers to be accessible in that way. You know, I in the past, for example, in the book of essays, Linwood Barclay writes about sending a fan letter to Ross Macdonald as a teenage boy.
Right, yes.
And, you know, getting a response back in the post, probably, you know, weeks or months later, when it eventually had gone from his publisher to his agent back to him, and he found time to sit at his desk and pen a reply. Now, you know, if you're on Facebook or Twitter, or readers have if you have an email contact on your website, people get really antsy if you don't respond in a day. You know, and
right.
Increasingly writers can spend an awful lot of time engaged in that kind of social interaction because either publishers have said that they should do it, or because if you read one of these books about self-publishing or getting yourself published, what they say is, you know, get yourself an internet presence and be out there all the time, hassling and marketing. That's not really what writers should be doing. And the balance has to be right. You know, so for the next couple of months, once I finish the kind of week of talking about this book, you know, I'm not doing anything. I'm going to write and go back into that kind of monastic mode where what you're doing is just trying to write books, because that's your primary role. And
when you get to do, and you get to do that, and you love doing that, and you love talking to people, so everything.
The balance is quite good, but it's an imperfect science, I think. And increasingly, the more books you write, the more demands there are on your time, and the more time you could spend talking to people or touring. I mean, I could spend a year touring. Probably,
right.
You know, given the different territories the book is published in, there's always somebody who says, can you spare time to come over? And that's very appealing. You think, yeah, why don't I go over to Oslo for 2 or 3 days? Or, you know,
right.
Or to France. But you get nothing done apart from the kind of conversation. And that's lovely.
You get lost in a conversation, too.
You do, absolutely. And it's wonderful for your ego, you know?
Exactly.
I remember going the first time I ever went to Bulgaria. I went to Bulgaria. I was invited to Bulgaria on a book trip. And it turned out that there had only been two English-speaking writers who had gone to Bulgaria since the fall of communism. And one of them was Lee Child, and the other was Jackie Collins. And so I was the third. And I remember, you couldn't fly direct to Bulgaria, so I had to go via Heathrow, because my home is in Dublin. So I was up at like 4 o'clock in the morning to get on the first Heathrow flight, so I would be in Sofia in Bulgaria in time for this thing. And so, and you know, if you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and you don't feel your best, and you probably feel a bit skanky and look a bit skanky. And I had a couple of bags of duty-free booze to give to the South African, to the Bulgarian publishers. And I had my luggage, and it was warm. And I remember Steph coming through kind of, it was a real Soviet-era airport. And I came with just kind of surly border guard, stamped my passport. And then I went out through the door, and all these flash bulbs started going off. And I did what anybody normal would do, which is you look behind you. You know, to see who's just come in that you
right.
might know. And then suddenly this bunch of flowers was put on my hand while I'm still holding my bags of duty-free, and this TV camera goes on. Because suddenly, you know, you may not be a big deal in Boston or New York, but in Bulgaria, you know, where people don't come that often, you're quite nice. And so that kind of thing, you know, it's surreal. In a way, you know, because you just think this is very strange, and I'm holding bags of duty free, you know.
Right. It's those moments in life that really throw you.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't have minded a bit of time to maybe have a shower, you know.
Exactly. Now, you edited this book with Declan Burke. You and Declan Burke. I should mention Declan Burke. We haven't really talked
absolutely.
About him. But did you guys just sit down and say, now who are we gonna get to be in this book with?
There was an element of that. We started off with a list. What you'd probably call the A-list, which was quite considerable. We said, look, these are the people that we're going to ask first. So people like Dennis Lehane, like Michael Connelly, like Sarah Paretsky, Elmore Leonard, you know, you've kind of got your list. And plus, there were one or two people who who very politely, so there weren't many people who said no.
Right.
But there were one or two who did, but did so very, very graciously. And they got kind of first dibs, I suppose.
Right.
You know, like I said, I knew if we were asking Michael Connelly, Michael would want to do Chandler. That was a given. And you're not going to
yes.
say to Michael Connelly, well, you can't. And whoever Elmore Leonard wanted to do, well, God bless you, Elmore, that's fine for you as well.
Exactly.
But suddenly what we found was that list was quite long of the kind of writers that we really admired. And some of them not necessarily the most commercially successful of writers, but writers that we thought were critically interesting as well. And once that list was gone, we were nearly there already. You know, and then there were people we knew who had specializations in certain areas, who were very good writers, but were particularly good on certain other writers. So I knew somebody like Max Allan Collins. If you want somebody to write about Mickey Spillane, Max Allan Collins is the best guy to go to. So we said,
it makes me want to read that book, Eye of the Jury. When I read that, I thought,
oh yeah, you do. It's a really interesting analysis of it. Or somebody like Megan Abbott, who wrote a fantastic novel last year called The End of Everything. But Megan Abbott's background is in writing about feminism in relation to noir novels of the 40s and 50s. You know, so she's got a really interest, and her essay on Dorothy B. Hughes is just brilliant. You know, so she's not perhaps the best known commercial writer.
Right.
But she was the best person to go to ask about this particular area. So there was an element to doing that. It's not quite loading the dice, but you do know that there are people you should possibly say approach because they have an area of specialization that's very, very good, and that they're interesting writers. So you know you're going to get an interesting essay out of them.
Absolutely. Even Tana French is in here, I think is one of the most amazing writers today.
Yeah, absolutely. And she was an interesting... Tana and I share an agent and an editor, so I know Tana quite well. And
I wish I did. I wanted to interview her so bad for her new book.
Yeah, she's quite retiring in her way. She doesn't do a lot of the... I think she'd like to limit the amount of the public stuff she does. She's very good at it, but I think she's one of the writers who's maybe the balance skews more to spending more time alone writing rather than doing a lot of stuff on the road. But she was interesting because she was one of a number of female writers. When I went into this, I assumed that most people would want to do Chandler and Highsmith and Ross MacDonald, and you know that they were kind of people that we'd all be fighting over. And actually, that wasn't what happened. But the writer that the most number of other writers wanted to write about was Josephine Tay. Now, I had never read Josephine Tay. I'll admit to my ignorance right up front here. I had not read her. But to a couple of generations of female writers, she was extraordinarily important. She was as significant a figure for them as say, Chandler or Hammett was for noir writers.
Right.
And so, you know, Tana was one of those people I had to say, actually, you know, we've got two essays on... We could fill the book with people writing about Josephine Tay at this point. We already have two essays on Tay. And then she opted for The Secret History by Donna Tartt and wrote a really interesting... But, you know, that was a book that she also... She was torn between the two, and she would have been happy to write about either of them. But I suspect her heart might have leaned slightly more towards Josephine Tay. And so, you know, since I've edited the book, I've read Tay to try and find out what it was that these writers latched onto. And so in the process of editing, I think both Declan and I encountered writers that we had never read. And we then had to kind of go and kind of scholar up a little bit on them, you know, so that we could at least speak from some position of authority.
Absolutely, yeah.
But you know, that's the pleasure of a book like this. It's not necessarily...
I'm so tempted to ask you right now, if you were stuck on a desert island and you could take three books with you, which ones would you take? But I'm so afraid you might offend some of your friends if you...
I probably avoid it by only picking dead writers, I suspect. You know, doing an anthology like this is a great way to make 100 friends and 1,000 enemies, you know?
Right. Why didn't you include one of my books? You know?
I mean, I've just been at BoucherCon here. This is where we're talking from. And, you know, I realized looking... I would occasionally bump into people and think, maybe you should have been asked, you know, and I'm looking at them wondering, are they looking at me thinking, why didn't you ask me? You know, because we could have, you know, the book could have been, you know, another, we could have made it 200 writers, but you wouldn't have been able to lift it.
Now, some of the writers are actually there. Some of the people that contributed to this book are actually there at BoucherCon, aren't they?
They are. We had a mass signing. We had about 30 or there were more. I think it was 30 authors gave up 2 hours so that people could just get their copy of the book signed.
That's
which
wonderful.
What was lovely about this book is that we advances for a book like this are going to be very low. You know,
right.
Nobody is going to make it. This book is operating on a huge black hole loss right from the beginning. but because we wanted to pay every contributor something small at least, so we gave everybody a bottle of very nice Middleton Rare Irish whiskey. That was their payment.
And that really was true.
That's what they got. Yeah, they got it. I mean, Middleton Rare is gorgeous, a really gorgeous Irish whiskey. But we wanted to give them something that they wouldn't buy themselves necessarily, because it's a premium whiskey, but it's still a nice token gesture of appreciation. You know, most people did it for next to no payment. You know, somebody like Jeff Deaver wrote 4,500 words on The Executioners by John D. MacDonald.
Because
writers, it's not a huge chore to be asked to write about somebody that you love. And yet writers were still very generous with their time and their expertise and their knowledge. Because I think they got the point of the project, which was to say to people, look, these are books that are worth reading. You know, these are books that should not be forgotten and should not be lost. And if somebody's giving me a chance to be an advocate for these books, then I will take it. You know, they got it right from the off.
And this is a great book. I mean, I was sitting reading this like midnight last night for like two or three hours straight, just reading all the different essays and enjoying them and saying, I can't wait to see what the next one is. You know, you can't wait to turn the page to see who's the next one and what their opinion is. And it's not like you ever say, well, I think that's a stupid pick. You know, you never do.
Yeah.
Everybody has to.
Even if there are books, and you'd kind of hope as well that there are books that you might disagree with, it's interesting to see a writer advocate for them. You know, it's interesting. So it's very interesting to listen to somebody argue a point that you don't believe in. You know, that's almost more impressive than agreeing with somebody, you know.
Right. And people talk about Elmore Leonard. Everybody seems to love Elmore Leonard. I mean, what is it about his books that resonate with people more than another author does? It's amazing.
You know, we all have those writers. You know, I'm a huge James Lee Burke fan. You know, Burke, I think, is just the greatest writer working in the genre at the moment. I think he's put up. But I also know, I remember
meeting. But at the same time, he's very descriptive, too. I mean, very,
yeah,
very
I
descriptive.
Yeah, I think that's probably that aspect of the poetry of his writing is probably what appeals to me, and particularly his evocations of landscape. I think he's the great writer about landscape in mystery fiction at the moment. But I remember talking to one of the other contributors in the book, an English writer, who just didn't get Burke at all. You know, he says, I just don't understand him. I think that's not what I like in mystery fiction at all. I think that's overrated. And so, you know, and he's a writer I respect an awful lot, but he didn't like Ross MacDonald either. We nearly came to blows. You know?
But isn't that that's the great thing? Everybody doesn't agree on everything.
No,
if they didn't,
right.
Be awfully
boring. It would be a very, very dull world if that were the case. So there's a kind of pleasure. For me, there was a pleasure sometimes in. There were books in the anthology that maybe I'm not a huge fan of, you know, and it was interesting to read those essays and see somebody making a point for them. And it didn't necessarily change my view of the book, but it gave me a different perspective on it.
Are you as well known as you want to be?
Am I as well known? I don't know, what does that mean in terms of sales?
Everything, yeah, sales and
you know, I think writers always want to sell a few more books. It doesn't matter what level you're at. You always think, I'd like to sell a few more books, mainly because all writers live in fear of being dropped. We all live in fear of it being taken away.
Do you really live in fear of that, though?
I think all writers do. All writers really genuinely do. We all think that we're going to be found out. We all think that this is going to be taken away from us, that we're going to write a dreadful book, and the publisher's just going to say, listen, this just isn't working for us. And you know, it happens in the trade. It's not unheard of.
Right.
And so I think writers are always looking to insulate themselves.
But you're so established now. I mean, established.
That fear still never goes away. And, you know, that doubt about what you do never goes away. I think it's a real part of the process of writing. Every book I've written, I've wanted to throw away after 20 or 30,000 words. I've just thought, this is rubbish. This is the one where I get found out. This is the one where whatever little well of inspiration I had has just run dry.
And you write very dark books, too. Very, very dark.
Certainly the Parker novels are pretty dark. Although even within that, I always think that even when you read the darkest of mystery fiction, there's kind of hope at the end of it. I always think that's really the interesting thing about mystery.
I don't mind reading dark novels as long as they don't depress me.
Well, that's it. We don't mind. I think one of the reasons why we read mystery fiction is to dip a little bit of a toe into that darkness. You know, I don't want to read. I know cozies is the kind of dismissive term that's used about some of them, and it's very unfair. But I, you know, we don't want to read mysteries in which nothing happens or which there's no
exactly.
sense of it's a bit defeating. You know, that's okay. That would be like a Samuel Beckett mystery, you know? Samuel Beckett detective, that's my next series, in which you investigate crimes that just haven't happened. But, you know, what we like is that element of threat, that idea that order has been disestablished in a way, the idea that there is a menace, that there is something unpleasant out there. But what we like about it is that somebody takes a stand against it. And at the end, what we get is a measure of justice. And I think that's what's appealing. Because what we know, I think what most of us realize, is that there's a difference between law and justice. What writer William Gaddis once said, in the next world we have justice, in this world we have the law. Those two things are not the same. Mystery fiction has never been happy with that disjunction. Mystery fiction is always on the side of justice, not necessarily on the side of the law.
But yet again, some people, there's not always justice in mystery novels, though, either.
But there's always a measure of justice. I don't think we would read a mystery novel in which the villain got away with it at the end and be satisfied.
I mean, nobody's ever going to catch Hannibal Lecter, really.
But what Harris does then is then put people even more monstrous than Hannibal in the books. He begins to load the dice a little bit, which I think is when the books get, it's, if you read Red Dragon, you know, obviously the Tooth Fairy is presented as something more appalling than Lecter, mainly because, you know, he doesn't have, that's nice, it's good taste in music, perhaps, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, same in Silence of the Lambs, Buffalo Bill is presented as something more appalling than Lecter. But I think it's a really interesting question, particularly about the Harris books, because I think what was really interesting about the early Lecter books was that, you know, Lecter was monstrous. You know, he was appalling. And, you know, there's a description in Red Dragon, I think, about him getting a hand free and attacking a nurse, you know, who's just done nothing and tearing a face off. You know, he is a monster. In the later books, Harris loads the dice too much because he's let Lecter go free and he has to present Lecter with people who are worse than he is. And so you get, you know, the weird guy who was played by Gary Oldman and Hannibal with half a face drinking child's tears, you know? I mean, these vaguely absurd things. Right. Or, you know, but then he did what I think the big mistake Harris made was to explain the monster. You know, he tries to give us an explanation for how Hannibal came to be. And it's such a lame, preposterous explanation that it undoes a lot of the good work that he'd done in those first two books. I mean, I can make a good argument for Hannibal as I quite like the ending of Hannibal, which most people, I'm not going to say what it is, obviously, which a lot of people really disputed. And I thought actually it made a kind of emotional and psychological sense. But I would just say, don't ever read Hannibal Rising.
If people read your books, can they get a sense of what you're like too, or what your life has been like?
I think that somebody once said that, you know, when you dream, that every character in your dream is a fragment of yourself, and I think in novel writing, every character in your book should be a fragment of you too, because otherwise, these are the only things you know for certain are the things you've lived through. You know, they're the only experiences, that's the only kind of validation for your view of the world. And therefore, I have given every sin I've committed to a character in my books. You know, and writing about people who seem appalling, I will try to find the part of them that's human, because most people are not evil. You know, people are selfish or greedy or, you know, self-interested or careless. But they don't, and most people don't actively set out to hurt other people. You know, even
it's the ones that don't care
that callousness is a kind of function of evil, I suppose. But most people are not intrinsically evil, and we justify the things we do to ourselves. You know, the man or husband or wife who cheats on the spouse doesn't do it because they actively set out to hurt their spouse. They do it because maybe they don't feel understood at the time. You know, they meet somebody and, you know, it all gets a bit pear-shaped. But they didn't actually set out to hurt the other person. But what they've done, the consequence is that they do hurt the other person. But it wasn't a conscious decision on their part that I want to inflict damage on this other person. We find ways to justify what we do to ourselves. And I find that interesting. I mean, even Hitler didn't get up every morning and think, right, I'm going to be evil today.
They didn't. I think it came naturally to him.
Well, it did, but they found a way of justifying it to themselves, where it didn't appear to be evil at all.
That's kind of disturbing even in and of itself.
Well, it is,
but that's
a kind of magnified example of what people do on a day-to-day basis, you know? People are interested in that way. So I tend to leave little bits of myself throughout the books, I think.
I love this one. I love this story called A Night for Screaming. What a great title.
Oh, that's the Harry Whittington book.
Yes,
yeah,
A Night for Screaming.
Screaming is a fantastic title.
But there are just some wonderful titles. Do you always have to pick a wonderful title when you write your books? I mean, you always think, this is going to be a great title.
Sometimes, I think it's Ian Rankin who once said he couldn't start a book until he had the title. But often with me, a title will come along halfway through a book. It's very rarely that I'll start a book and have the title in place.
Your new one, by the way, sounds wonderful, Wrath of Angels. I haven't read it yet, but...
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I think it's out in the U.S. January. I think it's a little bit later than the U.K., mainly so that I could do stuff for Books to Die For, I suppose.
Are there things that you won't write in books? Are there situations you won't write about in books that will never see in your books?
I think that I will be wary about the way that I approach certain subjects, I think, because I realize that the reader's imagination is probably... at least as productive as me writing a detailed description on the page. As I get older, and I think I'm getting subtler, I hope, in the way that I write about certain themes. When I started out, I perhaps felt that you had to shove people's faces in it a little bit. They had to go, look at this, see, isn't this terrible? And now I can probably do it in a sentence or two, I think. So in terms of, I think my books have probably got less violent as they've gone on. But I hope a little bit more subtler in the way that they approach those subjects.
And that's a point. When you read books, now I read a book by Cody McFadden called The Face of Death, which is the second in this series of books, which to this day horrifies me. I read it in a weekend and I put it down and I couldn't go near the book because I was so horrified and surprised at what it did to me, what the book did to me.
Yeah.
But then you think to yourself, well, what is that author like that he could write something like
that? I've met him. He's a very nice man. I think sometimes with writers there can be, and I'm not saying this is necessarily Cody's case, but there is a I sometimes pick up books and I think that the writer is actively setting out to shock the reader, that there is a sense that if people read a lot of mysteries, and people who read mysteries tend to read a lot of mysteries, that they've seen it all before, you know, that it's almost impossible to shock them, and therefore the only way to do that is to maybe go for a race to the bottom. You know, to find things that are more appalling and go, see this, that you haven't seen that on the page before.
Right.
And it's so redundant. And it's it goes back to what we were saying right at the beginning. It's a form of lazy writing. The easiest way to power a book along is to throw bodies at it. You know, Raymond Chandler used to say that, you know, when he ran out of inspiration or didn't know where a story was going, he'd just have somebody walk into a room with a gun. And then he said, I could never have two people in a room and keep more than one of them alive for any length of time. You know, and if you read something like The Big Sleep, it's one of the flaws, I think, in The Big Sleep, is that it's a bit episodic and it tends to rely too much on that kind of contrivance. So it's too easy to keep readers turning the pages by being shocking. Or you know, the easy one is killing women.
Or what kind of twisted mind would write a book like this? I mean,
it's cynical. I don't even mind the twisted part. Twisted is fine. I suspect James Ellroy is twisted, you know. But I don't think Ellroy is a cynical writer.
He might think you're twisted, too.
He might well do. But you know, there's a difference between being twisted and being cynical about the way that you use violence. And I think that's much more calculating. You know, I often think that it's why I think bad writers will often kill women in books. And it's an element of misogyny to it, but it's also because they know that a reader's emotional response to the death of a woman is different from a male emotional response.
That's interesting.
A response to the death of a male. We don't react as strongly to a male dying in a book. We just don't. We kind of take it as that, to some degree, it maybe goes back to cave life, but it's kind of what happens with men. You know, young men die at the hands of other young men. There's something more appalling to us about the death of a woman, maybe because we feel that we should be more protective of women. So therefore, if you want to goad your reader a little bit, you know, you'll kill a woman.
That's why I think that the death of an animal is so horrifying to people.
That's
because they're defenseless, you know.
It's a really bizarre hierarchy in mystery novels. The hierarchy is don't kill animals, don't kill children, don't kill women, don't kill men. That's it. That's the pyramid of needs in a mystery book. You know, if you want to alienate every reader possible, you know, start out your book by killing a cat, a dog, a child, a woman. And you'll never write again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you look at the movie Fatal Attraction, where they get a rabbit. You know that rabbit's going to die by the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah, you know, it is. And, you know, thank God that she didn't kill a dog. You know,
exactly.
We all would have gone to see that movie, you know. Most of us are still haunted by old Yeller, you know.
But I think it's, and I guess the director would say, well, it was necessary to show the horror of what the person was like. And maybe that's true, but it's still a horrifying thing to see a dead animal.
Yeah, but you don't. You know, in very, very subtle gestures, you can do other interesting things. I mean, I think one of the most horrifying moments in Silence of the Lambs is that there's a moment where Clarice gets too close to the cage in which Hannibal's being kept. It's when he's been moved into this big hotel because he wants to be out of his cell. And he leans forward and he touches her finger with his little finger. And it's a kind of, it's like a slug crawling up her hand. It's like she's touched something alien and unpleasant. And that says more about Lecter than almost anything else. It says that there is more impact in that than in the scene where he takes a guy's face off a couple of minutes later. You know, that's an almost masterly piece of writing.
Now, Kathy Reich writes about The Silence of the Lambs, the book in here.
She does, yeah. And she writes very interestingly about it. She's a big, that was one of those books for her, I think, when she began thinking about whether she could try to write. Because, you know, what Harris did and what a lot of male writers don't do is to put a very strong female protagonist front and center, you know, and say, actually, look here. The power in this book lies in this woman.
And that's what made Jodie Foster such a good pick to play her. I mean, she's strong and yet she's vulnerable too.
She does it very, very well. But then I think she had difficulties, I think I read somewhere, she had difficulties with Hannibal, with the ending of Hannibal, and didn't want to play Clarice in that movie.
Which you can't blame her. I felt that it was pretty horrifying too.
See, there you go. This is a conversation to have over beer at some point. I quite liked the ending of Hannibal.
Oh, did you?
I think it's justifiable.
And we'll always disagree on that, but who cares?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's like arguing about how long the Easter Bunny's ears are.
I mean, and you can just argue yourself silly with people about some of these picks, you know, and say, why would you pick that? Why not this one? Why didn't anybody pick this book?
It's the first thing that happens when the reviews began coming in. Well, this is great, but what about? You know, and even I look at it and think, you know, I wish Horace McCoy's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Was in there. And probably David Goodis's Night of the Hunter. Those two are like splinters underneath my fingernails when I pick the book.
I look at Ian Rankin's pick, Derek Raymond. I've never even heard of Derek Raymond.
See, there you go. But it wasn't as if I could go around to people's house, put a gun against their head and go, listen, you're going to write about Horace McCoy's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And the thing is, that once you begin, that way lies madness. Because you start saying, well, we'll put in two more essays just so those two can be in. And then someone comes along and goes, well, what about X or Y? And suddenly a book that's already nearly 180,000 words long begins crawling towards 200,000 words and becomes simply unwieldy, you know? So it's a book that in its English edition will be almost impossible to publish in paperback anyway because it's about 800 pages long.
Do you have writers today that you can't wait for the next one that you always read?
Oh, yeah. James Lee Burke for me. I mean, I'm saving Creole Belle for Christmas. I just think Burke is extraordinary. Slightly more guiltily, I quite like Daniel Silva's Gabriel Allon books, but, you know, in his books, you know, all the Jews are good and all the Arabs are bad, and I think the geopolitical situation is maybe perhaps slightly more complex than that, but nevertheless, he can write a pretty good thriller. I was like Colin McCulley's Harry Bosch books. I always find those interesting. I'm reading Karen Slaughter's Criminal at the moment, which is a book that deals with the past of the Atlanta Police Department, which I think is a really interesting book. I mean, a really, really very fine book. And I loved, I think having read Megan Abbott's End of Everything and her new book, Dare Me, I think Megan Abbott would probably be one of those people as well. There are always new writers to be discovered. You know, and then there are people, I'll always read Mark Billingham because I'm close to him, Declan Hughes. There are friends whose books I'll always read. But, we all have a handful of writers. It doesn't matter. The day their book comes out, you're in the bookstore.
Somebody included Laura Lippman's What the Dead Know. You know, I think that's a masterpiece.
We were very anxious that that book should be included, and it just happened that Bill Lothom said, I think that book is, if I was going to pick a book, that's the book I picked, and I thought, that's great. You know, that's a kind of one of those books that will take its place in the canon in 20 years' time. You know, that people will go, this is right up there with Highsmith. You know, I think it's an extraordinary book.
Do you believe that there are certain books that you write and you'll never write any better than that?
I think often writers will be one book in their list where they feel they just hit the nail on the head with that book. for me, it would be The Book of Lost Things, but that's not even a mystery novel.
And readers tend to, and just from people I've talked to, they tend to say, well, I expect every book to be like that one. Like, I want every book to be like What the Dead Know. I want every one of her books to resonate like that one did. And it just doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't at all. And readers, what readers want and what writers need to do are not the same thing. You know, what is good for you commercially may not be good for you creatively, and vice versa. The easiest way to make a living in mystery fiction is to write more or less the same book every year. Change a couple of details, change the nature of the crime, but every year bring out the same book with the same character. And people will buy it, and they will forgive you weak books because they appreciate the time spent with the character. But there are very few writers who can do that and not write themselves into a kind of trough.
And look at Lisa Lutz picks The Axe. You know, The Axe is one of my favorite books. I love The Axe.
That was one of those books. That was one of the Westlake books I had never read.
What a book!
Yeah, and especially in the current climate. You know, it's a book. It's a recession era book. You know, it's a fantastic book.
So it seems like no matter what where we are in time, it's very fitting.
Strange. Absolutely. Some of these books you can go back to again and again. Time will catch up with them over and over.
And you look at all the different ones that you get. George Pelicanos does one here, and everybody's. I mean, it's just so interesting. And I love Ann Perry's Mark Jimenez, The Perk, and I've read Mark Jimenez. I love him. I love the way he writes. And I thought, and you think to yourself, I didn't even know that writer read that writer, you know? That's what makes it so interesting. I mean,
absolutely.
It's just chock full of all these different things. There's Tell No One, Harlan Coben's Tell No One, and I love Harlan Coben's writing. I can't get enough of his writing.
That's an interesting book, and he's one of the examples of a guy who books the trend slightly, who didn't sell many of the Maren Bolitar books when he was writing them, and then moved away entirely from those books. That, you know, people were buying them, but and possibly the people who liked them just wanted more of those, and goes off and essentially kind of creates his own subgenre, which is, you know, this particular form of the domestic thriller. You know, he did something really interesting and got away with it.
Do your books have a theme running through them? I mean, is there one theme that runs through your books?
Childhood. Yeah. All writers just have one or two themes they come back to again and again.
Why is yours childhood?
I'm not sure, because I think it's that formative period. It's that moment when the child begins to turn into the adult, and yet when you're an adult, you bring all that stuff from childhood with you. You know, as they say, the child is father of the man.
Did you have a happy childhood?
I was a perfectly happy child. Yeah, no, none of that. I didn't have any trauma or anything, but I just find that interesting. I think that most people's unhappiness can probably be traced back to childhood, and most of the things that they do wrong in later life often have a little seed there. So in my books, it's often children in peril, or it's the sins of the parents being visited on the children. There's probably a gothic element in that way to them. But no, that's probably, if I had a theme, that's probably what it is.
Interesting. I never thought of that before. Now I'm going to have to go back and read all your books and see.
There'll be a test next time.
It's like, who was it? William Lashner always says, he has a scene in every one of his books where somebody throws up. It's like, why? Why would you want to do that? It's disgusting. But,
yeah, no, I might avoid that in future.
But sometimes something takes, you know, with Sue Grafton, it's the letters. With Janet Ivanovich, it's the numbers. Something takes, and you have to have Linda Fairstein with her final jeopardies in every book. It's just wonderful. You know, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Sometimes, you know, do we get tired of it? Do we get tired of the letters or the numbers or whatever? And that's the question. Do we like the way the person writes enough that we'll keep reading then?
I think that's what it is, and I think it's spending, if it's Sue Grafton, it's not so much, it's spending time with Kinsey Millhone. Most people wouldn't be able to tell you what the plot of one of the D novels was or the G novel, but they want to spend time with the character.
Except for Q. She really hit the nail on the head with Q.
I haven't read Q.
Yeah, Q is absolutely fantastic.
Well remembered.
And that's the beauty of reading, though. When you read a book, you know you're going to remember for the rest of your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just wonderful. Well, it's been nice talking to you. I know you have
David,
to go.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much. Sorry, I have another interview at 11. So.
Right.
But you're very, very kind, and I really appreciate the interest.
Yeah, and the book again is called Books to Die For. It's edited by John Connolly and Declan Burke, and it's fascinating. I hope you all get to read it. It's out from Simon & Schuster, Emily Bestler Books. Thank you very much.
God bless you, David. Look after yourself.
You too. This has been David's Book Talk. Goodbye.